Well, you all know who Ralph Nader is, so by way of introduction, I just want to give you some of my perspective on who Ralph Nader is. When I was a first-year law student, I remember coming to this room to hear a talk by a man named Tommy Austern, one of the professors at that time, one of the well-known liberal professors, said that Austern was the ideal lawyer, the model Harvard lawyer, who should inspire us to follow along in his path. That's what he said. Now, Tommy Austern was a partner in a very prominent Washington firm, practiced administrative law. As far as I could tell, his main accomplishment, or at that time anyway, had involved representation of peanut butter companies, having something to do with the definition of peanut butter, and I gather he won or something, was good about it. In any event, at that time, Ralph Nader, who was already well known, was kind of a counter-Austern from my generation. My best friend in the first year went to work for Ralph as a member of a three-person group that was the first so-called Nader's Raider group investigating the Federal Trade Commission in the summer of 1968. After my third year, in the summer of 1970, Lou Sargentich and I drove out to California, where we were a two-man Nader's Raider team, one of seven that was at work that summer. We were investigating various land use scandals in the state of California, including the Los Angeles airport. Since that time, Ralph Nader has imagined, created, prodded into life, led, nurtured, advised, funded, and spun off myriad projects and organizations, including the Appleseed Electoral Reform Project here at Harvard, most of which have become self-sustaining. He has, in addition, flourished as a public intellectual and an advocate and a provocateur and even as a public figure. He's written a whole shelf full of books, ranging from starting with, I think, Unsafe at Any Speed, originally and most recently, two books published this year, at least in paperback, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and No Contest, Corporate Lawyers and the Perversion of Justice in America. During the same time, he's testified heaven knows how many times before Congress. He's organized heaven knows how many lobbying campaigns. He's been on uncountable, I'm sure, a number of radio talk shows, on television. Perhaps you've seen him, for example, on the Politically Incorrect program. Just the other night, watching the Comedy Channel, I saw a rerun of Saturday Night Live, the Christmas show, and there, standing beside Bill Murray, who was wearing a Santa Claus outfit, was Ralph Nader, looking a little bit doleful, I have to say. I'm not sure whether he was singing along with the rest of the cast, but he was certainly there, and I was glad, as always, to see him. In addition to all of this, as you know, he ran for president. Run again for president this year. What's made Ralph Nader outstanding, in my view, is not just that he's shown that law can be used effectively as a tool for systemic reform, though certainly he's done that. It's not just that he's led in standing against the power of the rich and the power of corporations, though he certainly has done that. It's not just that he's exemplified the possibility of leading a wonderful life as a lawyer without enriching yourself, though he certainly has done that. To my mind, what's most outstanding about Ralph is that he has done all that he's done without playing any established role whatsoever. His energy and creativity and, most of all, resourcefulness in making and remaking himself has been absolutely astonishing. He is, in my mind, the protean professional person. So now I want to introduce to you the person who I believe is the ideal lawyer, the model Harvard lawyer, the person who should inspire you to blaze your own path as he has done.
you.
Thank you very much, Professor Parker. Thank you also for your extraordinary responsiveness to the whole Appleseed effort and to make students want to think beyond the boundaries of the permissible or the conventional. And I want to thank the law students, Raj and others who made this possible. It's not every Friday afternoon that one wants to speak at a law school, and thank you all for coming out. There are a number of approaches, I think, that we can take to a topic as broad as the laws, legal practice, and legal education. And whether we're continuing, as so many societies continue, in being restricted by our own illusions, our own conventional assumptions that we grow up with, or whether we're going to initiate a new era of wake-up time, so that the great catalytic profession that we are a member of, a society that gives lawyers a huge amount of leeway and elbow room to become generalists yet respected, or to become generalists and still be powerful, to bring together the inputs of a lot of other professions in the forging of public policy and the advancement of various positions. You know, most societies don't give members of the bar that kind of elbow room. In most societies, they're treated more like technical clerks. They are indeed treated as if they just represented clients, when we know from our profession's history that attorneys also have to be lawyers, and the distinction between the two is very often ignored at law schools, whether curricular or extracurricular conversation. The subject matter of the curriculum is very much a reflection of the power structure outside the law school, reflection of the job market, and if there aren't jobs in the area of pursuit of corporate crime, there aren't corporate crime seminars. Years ago, there weren't many jobs in civil rights or environment, and there were very few courses here at the law school, if any, on civil rights or the environment. We had a course at law school. It was called Landlord-Tenant. This is in the 50s. It was called Landlord-Tenant. I don't recall ever getting to the tenant. Harvard Law students were graduated to represent landlords, not tenants. And there wasn't poverty law as a separate body of law. But more important than just categories is that there weren't insinuations in the conventional first year and second year courses of, shall we say, a more popular interpretation of law as a public service. Who is the law supposed to be serving? Who is the law supposed to be utilizable by? Who is the law supposed to be accessible to? And so in the commercial law course, it was clear the jobs out there were representing business. They weren't representing consumers. We had a course called Creditors' Rights. It wasn't called Debtors' Remedies. What kind of retainers come from debtors? It was called Creditors' Rights, right? And the name of the course was the philosophy that was reflected. They could have at least called it Creditors' Rights - Debtors' Remedies. And so it went right through the whole curriculum. The tort law was taught with very little attention to engineering standards of care, product liability, medical malpractice, even though those were huge sources of preventable violence in the United States, defective products, harmful, negligent medical practice. The extent that we did the automobile litigation analysis, it was driver-to-driver combat analysis. Only McPherson versus Buick saved us from excluding the car entirely and the manufacturer's standard of care. We had a full-year course on criminal law, nothing on corporate law, little white-collar crime in April or May, you know, tellers stealing from banks, not banks stealing from customers. And it went right through. And the important thing here is that the lack of a public philosophy at the law school, the lack of reminding students that they were in a profession, not a trade, that a profession meant not only a learned tradition, which Harvard was very good at, but a measure of independence from their clients, especially their corporate clients, and a tradition of service. And Dean Roscoe Pound hammered this again and again in the 30s when he was a dean at the law school here. But it was forgotten in the 50s. And the triumph of technique, the triumph of superfluous rigor, the triumph of narrow expectation levels of the function of the profession, the triumph of forthcoming retainer astigmatism, the triumph of measuring success as a graduate of Harvard Law School by what big law firm you happen to be recruited by. That infected and depleted a much broader horizon, and I might say it demeaned the whole tradition of the law, because there were some extremely bright students at the law school. There were some very bright professors at the law school. If you didn't believe it, all you had to do was ask them. They felt they were the best and the brightest. Students, faculty, law review, 2,500 hours a year, the students would spend editing the law review, more and more about less and less. They'd have big fights over font mistakes and whether there's enough footnotes in terms of proportion of the pages. This is what I mean by a level of intellectual rigor that began to trivialize itself and reduce its horizons, maintain the blinders on its pursuit of scholarship. In the meantime, right in Boston and Cambridge, what did you see? You walked off the law school campus, and you see horrible slums in Cambridge and Boston, a decaying hub of urban activity. You saw great disparities of wealth. You saw local government bureaucracies that were insensitive to the people. You saw prison conditions and juvenile court and court conditions that were a disgrace to our country. You saw huge pillars of corporate power in downtown Boston fleeing to the suburbs at night and raking in the money by day, redlining neighborhoods, the banks, the insurance companies, and basically not having any sense of civic corporate responsibility, with a few exceptions, always the few exceptions. And yet, the students there never saw it that way. We were taught to be smart by becoming narrow. We were taught to be rigorous with tunnel vision. We never asked ourselves questions like, why is the deployment of lawyers in this country so terribly skewed to favor the well-to-do, the business establishment, and ignore the vast majority of the people who would have expected the law to discipline raw power, to tame power, to replace power, to elaborate institutions and opportunities that the law is so dutifully equipped to advance at its highest level of pretension? We never asked those questions. I would sit in class totally dumbfounded by the level of the controlling process, even though the Socratic method was a thing of beauty when it was done right, just a thing of beauty. But it was always in a narrow channel of expected responses. Let me give you an illustration. One day in constitutional law class, the subject was a criminal case in Texas and why the jury came in with a guilty verdict. And the professor was almost right out of 1L. I mean, he was, you know, right there in command, the usual brutalizing process. This is before the days of the flyouts and the flybacks and the resurgent of student disrespect for faculty, etc. These were the days when people were just sitting almost terrified in their seats. When Professor Kasner at Property, everybody knew that the first class after the Christmas holidays, he would call on a woman in the class. That was in the lesson plan. And they were ready for it, all 15 women out of 550 students. It would be four women on the average in the class. No African Americans. I think we had one or two African Americans. And we were constantly told that the law school was not discriminating. They'll accept anyone who's qualified. Anyone who's qualified. Now, that's supposed to be closing of the argument, right? How can you argue with that? Anybody who's qualified. You don't talk about LSATs. You don't talk about anything that now is discussed more openly. And we're sitting there, and the professor said, all right, let's hear the, why do you think the jury came in with a guilty verdict? And hands shot up. You know, maybe 15, 20, and he just cut them down like a machete. you know, like, ridiculous, absurd. Did you know the English language? Did you have enough sleep last night? You know, they all went down. And then there was one fella at the end of the row. He had three strikes on him. A, he was out of a seat assignment. B, he had dungarees on, you know. And three, he had his foot on the back of the chair in front of him. And he raised his hand, and the professor, sort of with a scowl, said, "Yeah, you, what's your response?" And the student said, "Well, Professor, maybe they came in with a verdict because the jury was all white." You could have heard a pin drop. The students turned around and looked at this pariah who had descended on the class with a irrelevant public policy intervention. Now, look at the difference. Within 3 years, the Supreme Court was rendering decisions on discriminatory jury lists, etc. Now, look, here we have, quote, the greatest law school in the country, and it was behind the Supreme Court in its discussions. The Supreme Court was ahead of it. Of course, we should have known better. You could never accuse Harvard Law School of foresight anyway, if only because you couldn't footnote it. The internalization of the norms of the law school was punctured only infrequently. Robert Hutchins came. He was former dean of Yale Law School at age 29, the president of the University of Chicago. He came to speak once, right here, in Austin Hall, and the place was packed. And the one thing I remember from that speech was the question he left us with at the beginning and at the end. He said, "What is the purpose of the Harvard Law School?" And we all looked at each other with total cynical disbelief. Like, what an idiotic question. What is the purpose of the Harvard Law School? We'll get to that in a moment. The point is, to what extent was progress made here in curriculum, in faculty, etc.? A great deal was due to student agitation and student challenge and the civil rights turmoil, the anti-war turmoil around the country, etc. I used to say that a lot of law schools had their conscience illuminated not by their own intellect, but by the fires in the urban riots and disturbances in the 60s. That's what shook up the law schools. And beyond that, a number of professors started re-examining what kind of courses were at the law school, what kind of extracurricular. You used to qualify for legal aid only if you had high grades. Only if you had high grades. It was just under law review and you qualified for legal aid. There was a grade hierarchy that was unbelievably Mandarin in its insistence. There were people coming back and they would look at someone walking down between Langdell and the Harkness Commons and say, "He's number seven. He came in number seven after the first year of law school." And everybody kind of, "Ooh, you know, number seven." Nobody ever said, "This student is a real vigorous advocate of justice in our country." No one said, "This student has experience coming out of the slums and is trying to reorient our priorities. We should have lunch with them." No one ever said, "Why is it that over half of humanity couldn't get in Harvard Law School because of how they were born?" Again, the best and the brightest. And they didn't see it. And when it came to corporation law, the absurdity reached new depths. Here we were with this big case book on corporation law by Professor Baker, and day after day it was Chancery Court, Delaware, Chancery Court, Delaware. Finally, some intrepid student raised the hand about the third month, said, "Professor, why are we only reading Delaware cases, it seems?" The professor said, "Well, it's obvious, because the jurisprudence in corporate law has reached a level of detail and diversity in Delaware more than any other state." No one said, "Hey, how come? I mean, General Motors could buy Delaware in a weekend if DuPont was willing to sell it. I mean, how come?" No one said, "How come?" So we didn't discuss the corporate Reno phenomena of Delaware, which attracted corporate charters from the big corporations for a state revenue input that at one time reached 30% of the state's entire revenues. And, of course, they did it by permissive jurisdiction, permissive law, giving offices, directors, far more power than anyone else in the corporate embrace. Again, the question wasn't asked. And now you have a more diversity of student, more diversity of faculty. You always wish it was more, but you should compare it with the 50s, where, you know, the act of nonconformity was the refusal to wear white buck shoes. Very, very staid decade, indeed. And the curriculum is more diverse. I had a course that was considered way off the charts in 3L in 1957, 58. It was medical legal seminar. Medical legal seminar. What's that? That's low on the totem pole. I mean, that just dealt with the interaction between medicine and law and things like trauma in motor vehicle cases, injuries. That was considered low on the pecking order. Notice the pecking order. The hierarchy of curriculum subjects and status for professors started with the heavyweight corporate subjects. It was property, and it was commercial law, it was securities reg. That was a big one then, X10B5. Whew. And it was corporate law, property too, taxation too. It's interesting. These were important courses. You should always try to take them even now when you have a broader choice. But they weren't the courses where the mass of the people interfaced or were rejected in terms of their needs to have their conflicts and complaints resolved and their rights pursued. That was the criminal law, and that was the tort law, and the contract law. We almost never talked about the vast bulk of contracts that people are engaged in, which is the standard form contract. We talked about and spoke about and discussed negotiated contracts. And that's true even today. About 1 hour in most law school courses on contracts is spent on contracts of adhesion, and the rest is on negotiated contracts. Even though trillions of dollars and the vast majority of contractual commitments are processed through the standard form. Well, as I say, the students agitated, and the Harvard Law Record wrote articles, and there were demonstrations, and sometimes there were sit-ins when cognitive forces and reason didn't prevail. The students had to physically impede the egress and entrance of the faculty, the various buildings, and the law school turned out much better for more people as a result. But by the same token, the challenges are much vaster now. They're much more complex. Just look at law firms, how they develop. Not only are there more law firms of a big vintage, but their subject matter, like intellectual property, is exploding with biotechnology, etc. Much more complex, much more intense. Still the same number of Harvard Law students, roughly. About 1,600 or so. Is that right? Total? Now, there were about, say, 25 big firms bidding for the students in 1958, and the highest salary was $7,500. I remember one law school graduate in my class got a $10,000 job with Bungie Grain Corporation. Everybody was totally flabbergasted. It was just awesome. And the ones who went to New Jersey had to work free for a year, to clerk, indentured servitude, legal style. Now you've got hundreds of big law firms, and they're bidding the same number of students. So the bid goes up. The temptations go up. Now the law school leaves you with a lot of debt. This is a poor law school, you understand that. There's every conceivable fiscal reason why you should exit this law school with tens of thousands of dollars of debt. Don't you know that? Do you happen to know what the endowment of the Harvard Law School is as of June 30, 1999? This is not the university. This is the law school. Anybody know? Once again, example of tunnel vision. What is it? That's right. It's almost $713,487,420.52. I'll leave the rest of the calculations for you. There's student-funded fellowships. You fund those. There's loan forgiveness programs. That's, you've got probably the biggest one in the country. And there are debts. I presume there's still some scholarships. Do you know what happens to you when you get out of school and you've got a 70, 80, including your undergraduate, 80, 90, $100,000 debt? You know what happens. You're risk averse. You don't even think of breaking new ground because you're in debt. The best way to pacify law students for the corporate mill is to let them get out with huge debts. Is that necessary? Maybe a fiscal analysis of the law school and a reorientation of what they're spending it on or what they're keeping it for is in order by the classes here at the Harvard Law School. Certainly a lot of construction costs a lot of money. The question is, what happens to a whole generation of law students who, at the cutting edge of their career, when they're likely to take that pioneering leap, when they still have a residue of idealism, when they have a passion to pursue a certain course of action, have to instead drop it, go to work for Cravath, Swain, Covington and Burling, Pillsbury, Madison, Ropes Gray, etc.? And it's not that easy to leave even after you pay off your debts. You get into a routine. The opportunity costs increase. You can rationalize the costs of a first home, second home, kids' education down the line. Who knows? It may be $150,000 a year in another 25 years. And pretty soon, the days meld into weeks. The weeks meld into months. The months into years. And you're applying for an unneeded Social Security benefit. You're very wealthy. You might have been elected heads of your local or national or state bar association, but you start having an empty feeling by that time. We know. We've interviewed many lawyers, great success, pinnacle of their profession, corporate lawyers, empty feeling. Why? They missed the justice bandwagon. They were forever well-paid secondary human beings representing retainers. Day in and day out, to a degree that even they, in their moments of greatest glory, realized they left too much of their conscience at home. They followed the ideology that they're only doing what every client deserves, zealously representing their client. No matter how wealthy, no matter how many other lawyers the client could easily retain, they felt that there was an obligation to represent that client in return for a nice retainer. And its price was retainer stigmatism. Its price, they forfeited their critical corollary role as a lawyer. Now, you have about 15,000 days before you retire. Assumptions about biotechnology aside, that's a little more than 2,000 weeks. And if you think last week went quickly, that's the way they're going to go. This idea was, well, I'll do something for 5, 10 years and becomes 15, 20 years. You become over-specialized. Your market value for other areas of the law is virtually zero. You're honed into a narrower and narrower slice of the profession. And you have your opportunity cost. Now, what is the role of the lawyer in contrast to the attorney? You know the roles of attorney. You're torn for a client, and you know the canons of ethics and zealous representation, all the rest. Now, what about a lawyer? You know, the moment you graduate from this law school, you are a lawyer. You're not an attorney until you pass the bar, but you are a lawyer. You're a member of the profession. In fact, Dean Griswold, when he introduced the first-year class, 1955, first thing he said was, welcome, class of 1958. You are now members of the legal profession. We felt good. Hadn't even cracked the book, and we were members of the legal profession. Now, we all know that when you pass the bar, you're an officer of the court. What does an officer of the court mean? What does it entail in terms of responsibility? professor wrote an article in Kentucky Law Review about 10 years ago asking that question. And his conclusion was that it means you have to obey the criminal laws, that it had just about no content in terms of professional obligation that could be imposed on you by the courts or by any other aspect or dimension of the profession. Not to mention, if it did have certain obligations, it would be generated from within, anticipating and forestalling any kind of compulsory service requirement. However, in the professional rules of conduct, there's a clue as to what lawyers are supposed to view themselves as. This is the American Bar Association Model Rules of Professional Conduct. Quote, a lawyer is a representative of clients, an officer of the legal system, and a public citizen having special responsibility for the quality of justice. There's one. As a public citizen, a lawyer should seek improvement of the law and the administration of justice. A lawyer should be mindful of deficiencies in the administration of justice. How many attorneys think of these words once a year? Now, what happens when we're all just a bunch of attorneys and we're not lawyers at the same time? We're just a trade. We're nothing more than a trade for the highest retainer. And as a result, a vast reservoir of injustice builds up and is not treated. It's like doctors not organizing the public health profession of their profession, that dimension, and just ministering to individual patients who have ability to pay a lot of money, forgetting most of the patients, and then not being able to do anything about epidemics or anything else, urban sanitation or anything else that the public health wing of the medical profession has been doing over the decade. And what are these injustices? A jurisprudential philosopher in NYU years and years ago, Professor Kahn, his name was, his books are in your library, once said, quote, you cannot have a sense of justice without having a sense of injustice, end quote. Daniel Webster once said, justice is a great work of human beings on earth, end quote. Now, who better to give content to that, leadership to that, direction to that, in all these areas, bureaucratic accountability, contracts, torts, corporate accountability, the great issues of arms control, of budget allocation of resources, access to justice, liberating workers for collective bargaining, taking the disenfranchised and the damned and giving them power, going after corruption, challenging the very essence of the corporate charter as a mechanism of non-accountability by state governments and to some degree the federal government. Dealing with the new technologies of computerization, artificial intelligence, privacy, genetic engineering, the most transforming technology in the next century. These have shredded and outpaced not only their science often, which is their governing discipline, they have shredded and outpaced ethical and legal frameworks. This is pretty shocking. We pay quite a penalty for doing that. Take motor vehicle engineering. That never generated an adequate science because they never wanted to support it in engineering schools because then it would graduate students who might challenge the existing stagnation of the industry. They like to hire them and, as GM said, teach them the industry way, end quote. Now look what we've accepted in terms of surface transportation. A horribly inefficient, a horribly extractive fossil fuel industry. Dangerous, dilatory, polluting, a laceration of rational land use planning, and undermining of modern personal mass transit alternatives. So devastating that if everybody in the world had the same per capita ownership and use of motor vehicles, an argument could be made that the world would not be habitable, given the internal combustion engine. And an industry that assumes it's a market response industry, it's efficient, has laid off enormous costs onto the public and to future generations in order to maximize its internal sales profit. This is what happens when the law is not there. Then when the law came in the 60s, the pollution levels were cut so that now, even with more vehicles, there's less motor vehicle pollution than there was in 1960, with massively more vehicles, including SUVs. Motor vehicle safety had to adhere to regulatory standards. Off the shelf flew some simple safety devices that have been around since the early 20th century. Seat belts, they were put in Air Force planes in World War I to keep the pilots from falling out. Nothing new about that. Collapsible steering columns, patented before World War I. Stronger door latches, anybody could have done that with just a little bit more metal. Head restraints, padded dash panels, that really took genius. It was the Greek physician Hippocrates over 2,000 years ago who said the human body can tolerate more readily colliding against a flat yielding surface than a hard cutting edge. Instead of all those cookie cutters on the old car dashboard, very simple things. The law said, time's up, enough people were killed, enough people have been injured, you got to put them in there. That's law regulating raw power. Fuel efficiency went from 14 miles per gallon, General Motors, 1974, average fleet efficiency. It's up 27.5, half of what it should be. But why? The fuel efficiency standards, plus the creation of a market for higher fuel efficient cars that beckoned the Japanese and the German auto companies as competition. The point I'm trying to make here is the cultivation of knowledge about injustice requires that law school be less empirically starved, that law schools be more empirical. It's not as bad as it was, but the idea that we only studied the law through appellate decisions in the 50s, and that's what West Publishing Company put in their books, appellate division. We had a tremendous argument in 58 at the law school over whether to have one course on trial practice. That was considered by some beneath the dignity of the school and of the law students. It's appellate lawyers they were training, if anything. Negotiators, appellate lawyers. The study of injustice is considered an intellectual no-no by too many in the law and economics school of thought. You all have read decisions by Judge Richard Posner. Extremely prolific, graduate of law school, writes his own briefs, has time to write a book a year, at least. As he put it in a recent interview, he said, Judge, how can you have time to write a book or more a year? He said, it's quite simple. I work nights and weekends, and at 4 pages a day, that comes out to 1,400 pages a year. A lot of books. He teaches a course at the University of Chicago. Eyewitness account. Comes in, first day of the course, a number of years ago, writes on the blackboard the word justice. Turns around, looks at the law students, says, see that word? I don't want to ever hear it in my class, in the whole course. Now, those of you who have been exposed to the law and economics approach to the law understand why he said that. It wasn't a flippant remark, but it was a very, very compelling trauma any attitude of jurisprudential inquiry. Justice issues are not issues that can be formalized through monetized minds and marginal utilities. First of all, you accept assumptions of cost that are industry generated, highly speculative, highly suspect. Second, you don't evaluate certain benefits because they don't come with numbers. And when you do, you get into deep trouble. What's the value of a human life for the formula? And thirdly, it's within a unique predilection to produce results that do not offend corporate power. It's amazing how consistent they are in showing how cost inefficient almost every regulatory standard is. in health and safety. The opening of the study of injustice is not a soft intellectual effort. When we were at the law school, normative questions were considered soft. Technical questions and issues were considered tough. But you know, it was Einstein who once said, "Physics is simple compared to politics." He should know. That was, I think, the worst disappointment I had at the law school, that they actually denigrated the intellectual status of normative thinking, of thinking about justice. And I suppose it's better now, but the service demands on law school graduates here and around the world, with the alternative being anarchy or market supremacy, or what you see in some other countries where criminal capitalism has replaced criminal communism, the inability to catch up with new technologies, the total inability to try to make public institutions more accountable, and the party line everywhere, the corporate party line everywhere. It infects us all. We all grow up corporate. The corporation is the dominant institution in our society. I can refer you to heads of American Bar Association and corporate executives who've written that. And what does that mean? It means we grow up looking at cars the way GM wants us to look at cars. We look at signing on the bottom line for all our contracts, if that's the way contract law should be. You know, you just haggle a little bit over the price, but you sign on the dotted line. We grow up not questioning the artificial fiction known as a corporation to see whether there should be different standards applied to it compared to real human beings. Can we really have equal justice under the law if General Motors is equal under the law to you? Corporations are different from you and me. Very different. Quite apart from perpetual life, corporations can be in hundreds of places at once around the world at the same time to maneuver their objectives. We can't. Corporations can create their own parents called holding companies to evade and perturb. We can't. Corporations go into Chapter 11 bankruptcy, still pay their executives and stay open. We have trouble doing that even under modern bankruptcy laws. Corporations can do a lot of things. They can diffuse responsibility and hide it. They can shift attention. They're much more powerful than human beings, and they can buy and rent politicians. They can fly to Washington to lobby Congress and deduct it as ordinary necessary business expenses. They can be caught price fixing and have to disgorge their excessive pricing to utilities in the Westinghouse General Electric price fix conspiracy. And guess what? Deduct the $1 billion plus payments back to the utilities as ordinary necessary business expenses. You get a traffic fine. Can you do that? Can you fly to Congress as a citizen and deduct your expenses? There are just dozens. And it's so imbued in us that we, even our imagery is indentured to the corporate perspective. Let me test it out. What comes to your mind immediately when I mention the following words? Crime, violence, welfare, regulation. I dare say, if I may presume,